Listening to SCR on 107.3.
Interesting, obscure stuff.
Good morning and welcome. It is final draft time on 2SER 107.3, and it's final draft for the last time in 2017. My name is Andrew Popel. I'm going to start by thanking everyone for joining me and sharing in the love of books for another year. It's not over yet, though. I have a great show today. I am joined by Katrina Menzies-Pike. She is the editor of the Sydney Review of Books, and we're going to be discussing the Sydney Review of Books' first publication. They are an online journal. Their first publication, The Australian Face, an absolutely amazing collection of essays discussing Australian literature and Australian cultural commentary. I think this is, I mean, if I didn't already have it, I'd want it under the tree for Christmas. This is a great way to complement and begin your exploration of Australian writing. I'm also going to be thinking a little bit about Christmas later on in the show. I'm going to be sharing with you one of my regular chats with Nick Healy on 2SER Breakfast, where we get into the Christmas vibe and discover a little bit of the historical Santa and Christmas storytelling. It's the last final draft. Enjoy the next half hour because I have enjoyed making it for you. My name is Andrew Popel. This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3.
Do you work in the glam sector? That's galleries, libraries, archives and museums. Well, we want to hear from you. Glam Slam is a brand new conference for archivists, librarians, researchers and curators, coming to you in 2018 and presented by the Australian Centre for Public History at UTS on March 1. There we'll be tackling the big issues facing cultural institutions today, and we'll look at what it means to work in the glam space. Right now we're shaping our program, so don't be shy. Pitch us a session, book a showcase booth, or present a lightning talk. To find out more and register, head to our website, uts.edu.au/glamslam. The Australian Centre for Public History at UTS are sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
The City of Sydney is taking over Shannon Reserve for an outdoor Christmassy pop-up. Take part in workshops to make your own personalised Christmas decorations. Receive complimentary gift wrapping for purchases made in the Surry Hills Village area on the day between 9am and 5pm, and enjoy live entertainment and artwork from Jeff McCann. For more info, visit sydneychristmas.com.au. City of Sydney, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
You're on 2SER 107.3. It's final draft time, last final draft for 2017. My name is Andrew Popel. And look, the end of the year, it's bearing down on us. It's a time of excitement, trepidation. And look, I think many of us, many final draft listeners, are going to be turning their eyes to the upcoming summer days and worrying over the correct curation of a summer reading list. Cricket is nice, but summer in Australia is really about long days spent with a book, and finally, the time to read. I am not immune to the competing pull of different volumes, and so it was with great pleasure that I welcomed the arrival of The Australian Face, essays from the Sydney Review of Books, a veritable word map designed to help me discover and think about Australian writing. Now, I'm joined right now via Skype by Katrina Menzies-Pike. Katrina is an author, a writer, academic, and most importantly, for the purposes of our chat today, she's the editor of the Sydney Review of Books. Welcome to Final Draft, Katrina.
Hi, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I really loved getting into this collection of essays. But before we start, just for the uninitiated, what is the Sydney Review of Books?
The Sydney Review of Books, Andrew, is a literary journal that publishes long review essays about Australian and international literature. We are an online-only publication, and we would say we publish Australia's best critics. And we publish the kind of long, in-depth essays on contemporary literature that used to be a fixture of all of our newspapers.
And you are in very safe territory here because they are exactly the sort of themes that we love to engage with on Final Draft. Now, the only thing I'd take issue with there is that you can't say you're online only. I have this beautiful edition of essays that you've sent out to me, and this is your first publication that's available for people to discover.
quite right. And I'm actually very used to defending the Sydney Review of Books as a digital publication and to fending off the suggestion that work published online must be somehow inferior. I often hear from people the suggestion that, you know, the Sydney Review of Books, which has been online for 5 years, must really be taking steps to get legit and go into print form.
It seems really strange to me because for myself, I mean, I love the feel of a book in my hands, but so much of cultural discussion happens online. And I mean, I want to get to some of that discussion because I think we can both agree that discussing and critiquing Australian writing is an important ongoing conversation. And it's happening in a very particular context at the moment. Can you give me an idea about the context of discussing Australian writing and Australian arts in Australia? What's happening at the moment?
Well, I don't think it's over the top to say that arts criticism is under huge pressure in Australia, and that includes literary criticism, where once there were a lot of different outlets publishing really different types of literary criticism, different, you know, taking part in this conversation about our shared literary culture. Radical changes in the media landscape have seen the space for discussion shrink. What that has meant in newspapers, on TV, on the radio, in literary journals, is less space for talking about Australian literature. By less space, I mean fewer reviews and shorter reviews, people getting paid a lot less to write them. It's a really hard time to be a critic, and it's hard to find a lot of commentary on Australian literature. We are, however, part of a kind of ecosystem of criticism, and there are large sections of that ecosystem that have disappeared, not unlike our beautiful Great Barrier Reef, over the past decades.
We have this wonderful collection, which is really a distillation of 5 years. I think it's something like 500 essays. And in the collection, we have this smorgasbord of offerings on topics as diverse as the survival of Australian classics and literary magazines to writing in an online world and hearing and acknowledging first Australian voices. Look, my question here, I feel like it's very clunky. It's not a good or an easy question, but where do we begin to find Australian voices given this diversity?
I think we look to points of beginning in bookshops, in libraries, in book clubs, in the recommendations of our friends. But I hope what you're asking me is well, what I see in your question is just the beginning. You know, we start with the books that are around us that present themselves to us, but we keep reading and we keep thinking about the relationships between new works of fiction and Australian literary history. We think about where new Australian novels sit with relation to other works of literature published around the world. I'm an advocate of keeping on reading of keeping on reading in a relational fashion. And that's where I think great literary criticism has such a powerful role, because critical essays like those that we've published here in this anthology don't work so much as a kind of a read this book, buy this book recommendation, but as a spur to thinking about a book, whether that's you know, a collection of Gwen Harwood's collected poems or Maxine Benavent Clark's The Hate Race, to thinking about books like this not only on their own but in context, and that context allows you to think about the next step in your reading process or the itinerary that you as a reader will take through Australian literature.
Yeah, I think we were on the same page with my. As I said, I had a lot of trouble formulating that question, and I think we are of a mind there, because when I look at offerings, say from Ellen Van Nieuwen in the collection to Michelle Cahill's reflections on Maxine Benavent Clark, reflections on Clementine Ford, I see these very different ways of figuring Australian writing. And the only way I can see to find this elusive idea of what is Australian writing, what is Australian culture, is to constantly be engaging at different points of, again, a clunky analogy, but different points of the compass. So now that we've established that this is very much a dialogue, this is a process, I'm really now interested in the way this necessary conversation about Australia and what it means to be Australia, what it means to be Australian, particularly in this current political and cultural climate. In her essay, True Colours, Michelle Cahill makes the point that fiction is a world which is ontologically supple when it comes to identity. But I wonder also about the way writing is viewed and critically engaged with. This is why I see the Australian face as such a gift. Literally, it appeared on my doorstep, but then also it feels like a gift to my intellectual world, because I wonder how often we're encouraged outside of publications like this or have the opportunity to engage in these conversations day to day.
Well, that's really great to hear, because when we were thinking about what to include in this anthology, we were thinking about, you know, what account does this give of Australian literature? What we have here is books that have won the Miles Franklin Award, you know, the big name best-selling novels that get read at book clubs, whose authors have really high profiles and are widely recognised. We have a lot of non-fiction here, which I think is an increasingly important part of the story of Australian literature. We have a lot of essays that are on what is rather unfortunately termed neglected authors, authors who don't, you know, have the kind of festival headline session star power. There are also essays here about literary institutions, about publishing practices, about critical practices, about literary magazines. Some of the books that are the subjects of these essays have been published by the, you know, the big publishing houses, and again, those are the ones that tend to have a much higher profile. Others are published by smaller and independent houses. There's even an essay on Moya Costello's Harriet Chandler, which is a self-published book. So I think what you get here, and what we were certainly hoping to convey, is a sense of the range of activity that can be grouped under the heading of Australian literature.
I'm joined by Katrina Menzies-Pike. She is the editor of the Sydney Review of Books, and it's our last show for the year. We're discussing the Australian face, and I'm actually going to say it's a beginning. This is a fantastic place to begin a thoughtful process of the reading and perhaps writing that you do yourself. Katrina, thank you so much. I think this has been just kind of the perfect round out to another wonderful year of reading Australian. And right now, we are going to take a track. I'm sharing some music from our feature albums from 2017 on the show today. Now, early in the year, I spoke with Holly Throsby around her book Goodwood, and she also released an album at the time. The album was called After a Time, and this is Holly Throsby featuring Mark Kozelek with What Do You Say?
What do you think?
I'm thinking less.
What do you know? I know myself.
What do you lie?
I love you still.
Well, what do you say?
No, you said best.
Tuned in to 2SER 107.3. It's Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. Right there, we heard a track from Holly Throsby. We are going back to some of the feature albums from 2017. That was right back early at the beginning of the year. The album was After a Time, and that was Holly Throsby featuring Mark Kozelek. What Do You Say? I really enjoyed that album. Spoke to Holly last year about her debut novel, Goodwood. So it's great to feature some amazing Aussie music. Now, we haven't got much longer left on the show. It's the last show for 2017. And I wanted to get a little festive. You may know, you may not, every Tuesday, Nick Healy from 2SER Breakfast and I get together and we chat books in the 2SER Book Club. And all December, we've been feeling very festive and Nick and I recently, we discovered a little bit about the historical Santa. And our discussion really ranged quite widely and looked at how Christmas is really just a compulsive reinventor of storytelling. Here's our conversation.
Tuesday is time for Tuesday Book Club. Now, as we edge into Christmas, we've been promising you that Andrew Popel, host of 2SER's own Final Draft, is going to give some of his incredible suggestions come the Christmas period. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Nick. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, we've had this conversation, I think, more years than we should have had. We've been doing this for a very long time.
Oh, we have.
My firm belief that the only two presents anyone ever needs is a bottle of wine and a good book.
Yeah, but bring them together.
Oh, absolutely bring them together.
I think a kind gift giver is actually going to look at how long the book is and maybe a magnum for one of those longer books.
A magnum would be a very kind present indeed.
Yeah,
all definitely. Right, what's today?
Look, Nick, today there's something about this time of year. Look, it really gets me thinking more than usual about the ways we tell stories and their importance in our lives. So did you know, Nick, that before it was the Grand Feast Day, on which we sacrifice ourselves at the altar of capitalism, Christmas was actually part of an oral storytelling tradition borrowing from several cultures and points in history.
I did not know that at all.
From winter solstice festivals, Christian foundation myths, and the elision of competing feast days, the increasingly expansive celebration of Christmas, it loves a good story as long as it can be strong-armed into doing the holiday service.
Mm-hmm.
So, Christmas is, in fact, I think, the apotheosis of viral storytelling. No other cultural phenomenon. Sit with me on this one.
I'm with you. I'm with you for the moment.
No other cultural phenomenon I can think of has such ability to infect and overtake its host to the extent that we get uncomfortably shoehorned Christmas specials produced annually just to take advantage of the season. the Star Wars Christmas special from 1978, I'm looking at you. Mwah. Bonus points. Oh, I'm going to challenge you, Nick, but I'm challenging the listeners. Bonus points if you can name the Wookiee Christmas holiday and which major Star Wars character was actually introduced in the special. You'll be surprised. Maybe ask me at the end.
All right. Okay.
So I thought we might spend some time thinking about storytelling at Christmas. And to that end, I've been reading up on the history of that most Christmassy of icons, Santa Claus.
Yay!
Yeah. I think a lot of us feel that they have the general outline of old Santa. Jolly, red-suited, questionable labour and workplace practices. You might even have the sense that our modern conception of Santa Claus emerged in the late 19th and early 20th centuries as part of the unholy trinity of advertising and consumerism, all marinated in Coca-Cola.
I have heard things like that.
To get to the real Santa, though, we have to go back to a 3rd century Byzantine bishop named St. Nicholas of Myra. And this is around the time I should probably do my usual apologies for pronunciation. I think it's St. Nicholas of Myra. About now, you're probably nodding your head and thinking, ah, St. Nick, in knowing like certitude. So Nicholas of Myra is the figure who would ultimately take over our collective imaginations every December as a holly jolly homebreaker, but he took a fair journey to get there.
He did.
Nicholas is in fact the Madonna of early Christendom, and you might want to play a sheet if you're joining at home. I am talking about the like a virgin Madonna here. That didn't clear it up.
That didn't help at all.
No. Suffice to say that Nicholas was the queen of innovative, timely and necessary reinvention, all designed to survive and stay relevant. All the more impressive, too, because he did most of it after he was dead. In his early posthumous career, he benefited from piggybacking alongside another, slightly better documented, St. Nicholas of Sion, and may have even gotten a few places of devotion from his younger mate. St. Nick was also the beneficiary of fading pre-Christian religions and managed to travel the world as a patron of seafaring types when Poseidon was passed over the first round selections. They both had beards, so, you know, nautical.
Okay, that makes so much sense.
One particular in St. Nick's life really got him going on the Santa biz, though. As a bishop, he found out a local family had fallen on hard times and the father was about to sell his daughters into sex work. Bishop Nick was having none of this, so he broke in during the night and left a bag of gold, which the father used as dowry to secure a husband. Now, if that story didn't have enough problem, I can see a smile, but this is true.
No, I'm very familiar with this story.
Yeah. Now, if this story doesn't have enough problematic and creepy elements, this happened twice more with the other daughters until Nick was finally caught and got a solid rep, because he was a white guy, as a generous homebreaker. Fast forward 1,000 years and we have a patron saint who's travelled the world, has a solid beard and a rep for generosity. All that's missing is some brand colouring and a million kiddies trying to nut out the physics of his overnight travels. So it's about hearing the story that I think all of those weird and out of continuity Christmas specials start to make sense. This was always the Christmas way, jumping into an existing space and infecting it with tinsel. I'm still looking, and this is, you know, we've got a couple more weeks to talk about this.
We do.
I'm still looking, and I'm looking for what makes these Christmas stories so successful and why we keep coming back to them. But in the Nicholas story, there's an inkling of what we might think of as the mimetic nature of Christmas, or what Terry Pratchett might have crafted as the potential that emerges from anything that has sufficient belief placed in it.
Interesting.
So what's next, though? Could St. Nick actually, you know, go online as some sort of avatar for an online juggernaut? I want to, before we finish, too, Nick, and a shout out to Jeremy Seals, Nicholas, the epic journey from Saint to Santa Claus, because a lot of the biographical historical information I got was from reading that book. That's kind of our book club book. If you want to check out the history of Santa, Jeremy Seals, Nicholas.
That actually sounds like a great thing to be checking out.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Now, a couple of things. One, he's also the patron saint of pawnbrokers because it was a pawnbroker he gave the three bags of gold to. And you can still see on King Street at the pawnbrokers in Newtown today, you'll see on the sign representations, three little balls on there that represent the three bags of gold that are still the symbol of pawnbrokers around the world. Fun fact on that one.
Oh, wow. If you want to find me this Christmas, I'm going to be walking down King Street looking at that.
And on the other side of it, I'm going to say Boba Fett and Name Day.
One out of two.
Damn!
Boba Fett and Life Day.
Life Day!
Yeah, the 1978 Christmas special was horrendous, but yeah, it gave us Boba Fett.
It did give us Boba Fett. Andrew Pupple, thank you so very much for that.
This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3, and I'm Andrew Popel. That was me speaking with Nick Healy on 2SER Brekkie about Christmas and storytelling. Now, if you want a little bit more bookish festive cheer, stay tuned to 2SER Brekkie for the next couple of Tuesdays. And in fact, this Tuesday coming up, we've got a very special gift guide for the holiday season. Now, it is time for me to say goodbye. I want to thank every single one of you for tuning in this year. It is so fantastic to have the opportunity to talk books with all of you. And it really wouldn't be possible without amazing listeners, amazing readers. So I thank every one of you who has enjoyed, who contributed during Supporter Drive. If you still want to support, go to 2SER.com, click on the box that says support, and you can become a 2SER supporter. Your help is so important to what we do here. Look, I want to say thank you to Nick Healy. He and I have worked together all year on books. I want to say thank you to Katrina Menzies-Pike, who joined me this morning to discuss the Sydney Review of Books essay collection. And I want to say thank you to every single reader. We do this for the love of reading. It's time for me to go. Stay tuned for The Vulture's Nest. I'm going to leave you with another track from a 2017 2SER feature album. This is from Laura Marling. The album was Semper Femina. This is Next Time. I will be back next year, 2018, another year of books to discover. My name's Andrew Popel. I'll see you next year for more Final Draft.
It feels like a long time since I was free. It feels like the right time to take that seriously. It feels like the trees are a peculiar green. It feels like the air is heavily. I don't want to be the kind struck by fear to run and hide. I'll be better next time. It feels like warning signs were there for us to see. It feels like they taught us ignore diligently. I feel her, I hear her weakly scream. Am I really so unkind? Turn around and close my eyes. I'll do better next time. I'll do better next time. It feels like the last time I'll run my fingers through your hair. I can no longer close my eyes.